This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Condoleezza Rice visits the Middle East and comes up with very little. Plus, truck displays with words like pickaninny cannot be banned in Arizona. Joining us today are Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Bob Meadows, staff writer for People magazine. So thanks, everybody, for being with us. And let's go straight to Condi. She hosted talks on ways to build an independent Palestinian state and also to incorporate the needs of Israel. But it appeared to yield little other than a pledge to meet again. The Israeli Prime Minister and Palestinian Authority attended, the leader. It was hoped that the talks would signal Rice's deepened commitment to resolve the conflict, but instead it looks like more difficulties ahead. So, Michael, you and I have talked previously about whether or not the Palestinian government should deny the right of Israel to exist. That is, once again, the sticking point here. What's going on? What can break the impasse?
Well, the Palestinians have got to say those words. You know, it's like that movie, Delivering Milo. I want to be born. The Palestinians have to say those words. Israel has the right to exist, free of violence, period. And they cannot seem to bring themselves to doing that. They can't seem to accept the right of Israel to it. And its leaders keep saying that, you know, Israel is a mere geographical expression. It's an imaginative expression. It doesn't really exist. It doesn't have a right to exist. If they can't come and speak truth, then they will not have the kind of cooperation they need to make their government in Palestine, or the Palestinian state for that matter, work. They're just not going to have that cooperation. They may have prevented a civil war in the interim because of the Hamas and Fatah factions' new coalition government, but the money's not going to come in there, and they're just not going to get the cooperation of the international community.
Laura, can you top Michael Myers quoting that movie, what is
Delivering
it?
Milo.
Delivering Milo. Don't believe I've ever seen that one, but...
I haven't seen it either.
Laura,
I got to go out and get the DVD right away.
Exactly. I'll spring you from the pop culture reference.
Thank you.
But really, this is a situation that sounds like a complete impasse. So many American administrations and presidencies have tried to bring some semblance of cooperation to the Middle East. And a question that comes up again and again is America an honest broker? Can America, with its own foreign policy interests, act as a peacemaker? What do you think about that question?
Well, I think the answer is implied in your question, Farai. Right now, our standing and our credibility internationally, but in particular in the Middle East, is so low. And look at this trip. You know, Condi Rice is, by making this trip, basically the only thing she's doing with the last several trips she's made to the Middle East is building up her frequent flyer miles, because there's just no way at this point she's going to be able to salvage the Bush administration's diplomatic legacy on this issue of Israel. Now, as you point out, previous administrations haven't had much luck either, but at least they made the effort, and at least they appear to be seriously negotiated. And they were, again, negotiating from a position of strength, from the position of still being seen as the world's great power. I'm not so sure if the United States is viewed that way internationally anymore. And because of all the other international problems we have, in particular in Iraq and Afghanistan, it just doesn't allow us either the political capital or the resources or maybe even the political will to be able to make any change here. But I think right now, because of the impasse, because of the Palestinians' refusal, and I agree with Michael, their refusal to recognize Israel, it wouldn't matter what we did. It wouldn't work.
Bob, let's look at this from a people perspective, if I can go straight to the name of your magazine.
You've got
two leaders, Olmert from Israel and Abbas from Palestine, who are in some ways very much in the shadow of their predecessors, two strong men who stood for their entire nations. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that now Israel and Palestine are really run by men who have not as much history as the men who preceded them?
Well, it's probably a good thing, I would think, because you were never going to have a situation, and you had a situation where Yasser Arafat came to the table, and obviously nothing happened, and people just couldn't get past who he was, who he was connected to, the terrorism that was just tied to his name. At least now that you have these two new leaders in there, relatively new leaders in there, it kind of opens up the field. It gives a new horizon, and you might think that it's sort of a new day, but as Michael and Laura have said, you know, Palestine still is not going to acknowledge Israel and their right to exist. That's just an amazing statement. And of course they can't, because they have these people back at home who, sure, the leaders can acknowledge that they exist, but that doesn't mean that the people back at home are going to say, well, but wait, they killed my brother, they killed my sister, they bombed our village. They're still going to hold these against them. So on a people, personal, non-political level, this is a situation that reminds me very often of the gangs situation here in the United States, where people just cannot get past what happened in the past.
Well, I'm going to move on to another controversial topic. Very different. Lawmakers in Tennessee are pushing legislation that mandates death certificates for aborted fetuses, which would in turn create public records of women who have abortions. A Republican representative said his bill would provide a way to track the number of abortions performed in the state. But abortion stats are already available through the State Office of Vital Records. Now, the identity of women who had abortions are not listed on these records, but the death certificates could list their Social Security numbers. Bob, what does this all mean? Is this just a way of trying to put a scarlet A for abortion on women, or is this a much-needed public health issue?
It is not a public health issue. I almost applaud this because it's so deviously, evilly brilliant or whatever you have it. This is obviously pro-life, anti-abortion groups. This is a ploy. This is a PR move. They're getting all this attention. They want to. It's an intimidation tactic against abortion, and they don't want abortion. So why wouldn't they try and do something like this? Does it have a chance in hell of passing? I don't think so.
Laura, when you look at abortion statistics, they appear to have been flat. Some argue that they've actually gone down a bit. So is this really something that's necessary?
Well, if you're a pro-lifer, if you believe that abortion is murder, of course you would feel it's necessary, because you wouldn't want to tolerate any abortions. But I think the real issue is whether or not this law is necessary, but whether or not it's a blatant invasion of personal privacy. And I just can't imagine anybody who's advocating this feeling the same way if we were talking about publishing information that would identify folks who had had other kinds of procedures, personal private procedures, hysterectomies, what have you. As they are suggesting that we do an exposing, this is as has already been said, it's a form of intimidation. It's just another way around respecting the law. Some of these same folks have advocated bombing abortion clinics. Some of these same folks have advocated harassing and threatening women and blocking their entrance to abortion clinics. These people will try any tactics they can, and they don't necessarily – they talk about respect for life, but they obviously don't have a respect for the folks that they're trying to intimidate.
Well, we have to say that some people do use violent methods, and other people who are anti-abortion do not use violent methods. But, Michael, moving on to you, I had a conversation once at a kind of a think tank gathering with a guy who considered himself very conservative, and he said that there's two things that divide America that we're never going to agree on: racial integration and abortion. Do you think – I thought it was interesting that those were the two. But do you think that abortion is intractable? It's one of these issues that we will never find peace on in America.
I'll save my statements about racial integration for another program. With respect to abortion, we have agreement. That's the problem with this effort in Tennessee. It is now settled that women have a right to control their own bodies, and that a fetus is not a live birth. You cannot have a death certificate in the absence of a birth certificate. So if there's not a birth, how can there be a death? This is semantics. This is an inversion of the rhetoric, if you will. An abortion is a medical record. It is not a birth certificate. So yes, as Laura suggests, there are privacy considerations, and there are federal laws that trump any effort on the part of Tennessee to violate a woman's right to privacy in terms of her medical record. And I have to say, is this Al Gore's state? No wonder he lost it, as I recall, in 2000. He had to get back there and do some groundwork and some grassroots effort to get people to join the 21st century.
No, he's working on global warming. Anyway, talking to Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Also with me on today's roundtable, we've got Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Bob Meadows, staff writer for People magazine. Bob, want to move on to Barack Obama, who will be getting plenty of ink in the upcoming months. Now, one of his nemeses or rivals, Democratic Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois, is questioning how Barack Obama portrayed his role in a community organizing situation in Chicago. In Dreams from My Father, he said that as a 24-year-old, he initiated and led efforts to remove asbestos from a Chicago housing project. But Rush says, no, it was another activist, Hazel Johnson, and journalist at the Chicago Reporter, who really pushed this to the front burner. Mm-hmm. Is this just an inevitable misunderstanding on the campaign trail, or does this speak to burnishing the political image at all costs?
Well, it's probably both, but I don't think this is a very serious charge. But sure, of course, Barack Obama certainly knew that Hazel Johnson was working on this project, too. He certainly knew that because he was so involved. Sure, the layperson wouldn't know, but he had to have known that. But yeah, that doesn't take away, though, that it was not an inspirational moment for him. And even the people who were involved say he was our motivator. He was certainly a motivator in this. He had a big role in it. He may not have been the only person doing it, but this is politics. It's not really a surprise. Rush, as you mentioned, Farai, has been a rival of Barack's the last couple years. It's just continuing, and we're going to have more of the same for the next year and a half.
Laura, you're in Chicago. What do you make of this?
Well, I haven't seen the actual story yet, but I suspect that the Chicago Reporter story is a story that I edited. And yes, we did some journalism around that issue. There were many community activists involved with that issue in terms of environmental racism in a very depressed community. Barack Obama did work out there. The problem with these kinds of stories is that it's been, 15 years since the fact. He wrote a autobiography that in many ways was partially fictionalized because he acknowledged himself he used fictional techniques. He changed names. He didn't vouch for the complete total accuracy of every reference to every person in that book. So it leaves a lot of room for interpretation. This is what happens when you write books that then can be scrutinized very carefully many years later. And it's another example. The LA Times broke the story. It's an example of, the good old media. You can always depend on them to build you up. And then as soon as they get you way up there at the top, they knock you down. The media is an institution that made Barack this political rock star. They got him up there now. Now they're going to take him apart, and they're going to analyze every single dot and T that he has done either in his books or uttered in his life.
So, Michael Myers, is this a situation? No memoirs until you win the presidency.
Those bottom feeders at it again, huh, Laura? Look, mm-hmm. I think that he wrote a book, and what people do when they write books, they write about themselves. They don't remember every I, every I and cross every T. They don't remember every activist. And even if they do, they're not writing about the activist. They're writing about their own role. It's an ego. It's an exercise in ego. Yes, it's breastfeeding. And Barack is guilty of doing the same thing everybody else does who does an autobiography. They take too much credit if that's the accusation. They took too much credit. But, as Laura had described the book, it's an interesting book. It's a way of constructing a book which tries to make it of interest to your readers, but the most important thing for an autobiography is that the book is interesting you, the person who's writing it. And I think this is what Barack Obama did. And so I haven't read his book, and this story doesn't lead me to want to read his book. I will find out about Barack Obama on the campaign trail as there will be more and more stories coming up examining his background, because this is what they do. in presidential campaigns. This All is right. what the media does. It's the
well, Michael,
freak show.
I have to jump in because we have a speed round question. We only Yes-oh. Have a minute and a half left.
Okay.
Pickaninnies on trucks. Splash guard with the word pickaninny, of course, a derogatory term for black kids. Arizona, it had a bill proposed to make these displays of racism or sexism illegal. It decided not to pass that. Are we better off for having free speech, or are we worse off for having derogatory speech? Speed round, Laura.
We've already had, we always had free speech. If you looked at some of the bumper stickers you see, not just on trucks, but on cars, there's all kinds of outrageous things that people put in their windows, put on their cars, and they have the right to do that. I think when you see crazy stuff like that, it just reflects more on the folks that are driving around with those kinds of things on their cars than it does on anybody else. So let them have it.
Bob?
I have to agree. I think that freedom of speech is a great thing. You have to be able to back it up, though. You can say whatever you want, but you got to take the consequences.
Well, Michael Myers, I say it is very plain that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. What's so difficult about understanding that? Congress, and you apply it to the states, meaning the legislatures. You do not abridge people's speech. Let people speak on their bumper stickers, in their community meetings, wherever. Let them speak. And please don't try and legislate what I have on my bumper sticker if I should have a car, which I don't.
Well, if you had a car, would you have one of those?
It would be an outrageous statement, I can tell you that, but it would not be obscene.
Yeah, all right. Well, we will leave it there. I'll have to think of a snappy bumper sticker to put on my car. Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Bob Meadows, Staff Writer for People Magazine, both at our New York Bureau, plus Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist at member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And as always, if you'd like to comment, you can call us at 202-408-3330 or send an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Plus, next on News and Notes, retired NBA player John Amici speaks out on coming out in his book Man in the Middle, and one woman shares her thoughts of loving, leaving, and letting go of her wedding ring.